The door is open, the hearth is lit, but you don't hear the familiar greeting you've come to expect from the innkeeper. The air is filled with the same warmth and welcome, but there are new smells from the kitchen and new sounds from the stage. And that's when the memory strikes you. The keeper is far to field, and those who wander have come home. You settle in for a new experience from one of the wandering bards.
Hey, Sinine, it looks like you're going to be up soon. I figured I'd let you know in case you need to get ready or something.
Oh, what's that, Benny? I'm up next? Great, thanks. I'll be ready.
Now, I know some of you folks like to go by fancy stage names, so how would you like me to introduce you?
Yes, you can introduce me as Sunflower the Bard.
Well, what you got there? Working on new ballads? I love your ballads.
No new ballads. I'm actually just going over my to-do list. If I don't write it down, I am guaranteed to forget it. And I cannot forget my party's compass again.
Oh, so just boring stuff then. Well, no worries. I gotta do all sorts of stuff like that for the boss.
Boring? Goodness, no. It may be a list, but it is in no way just a list. This list is full of stories. Take a look. Number 1. Buy rations. At least 14 days worth. My adventuring party has quite the big quest coming up in a few days. We were lucky enough to be the first party to answer the quest posting, which simply read, "Adventurers needed, requesting assistance in the recovery of a precious artifact. Reward negotiable." Now, while the negotiable reward bit was what caught the eye of my companion Tilgar, the thing that caught my attention was the word precious. I've seen enough quest postings for the recovery of artifacts that were less about recovery and more about finding skilled but stupid people to engage in obtaining things of questionable ownership through slightly illegal means. But those ads usually use words like valuable or expensive to catch the eye of the greedy adventurer. No, the use of precious made me think it was something a little more important and personal. And I was right. This old duchess has hired us to recover an old family heirloom that was lost generations ago. She's become a bit of a family historian and... oh, I guess that's a story for another time. Anyways, questing soon, rations needed. You can never be too careful about food. Number 2. Find a topaz of the windswept plains. This one is for my mom. Not much of a traveler herself. She was always content to stay at home. But she does love to adventure vicariously. She collects shiny artifacts and the stories that go with them. Judging by her collection, she's been at least halfway around the world by now, without ever leaving her rocking chair. Adventurers may travel far and wide, but they always need a place to come home to, she says. She likes providing that cozy hearth that my brothers and sisters love to come home to. Though you know we're only welcome through the door if we have a treasure and a dale. Number 3, buy matches. Alright, I'll admit that one's pretty boring. No, wait. How could I forget? Here's the story behind why I need to buy matches. Our last quest did not go as smoothly as we are accustomed to. By the time we got to the Cavern of Char, we were tired and starving and started a fire to cook up a bit of our remaining food. That's when we discovered that I was the only one who still had matches. Baggy is spontaneous, so we weren't surprised that he didn't have any. Flint likes fire and gets bored easily, so had apparently run out of all of hers. The rest of our party appeared to be out as well. And after starting that fire, I had only 3 matches left. We went to sleep and Flint swiped a match during her watch to play with. The next morning, though I thought we should keep the remaining 2 matches for emergencies, Baggy refused to go into the cavern without a hot breakfast, so we used one to rekindle the fire. We decided not to light torches right away for the sake of stealth, since most of us can see pretty well in the dark, and entered the cavern. Once we were a few hours deep into the tunnels, we began to hear shuffling. We thought the noise must be coming from goblins and decided to use the last match to light a torch and hopefully scare them off with the fire.
How'd that work out?
Turns out they were kobolds.
Oh boy.
So, that didn't work out so great. Yeah, we need matches. Number 4, write a ballad about the kobold fight.
Oh yeah.
That'll be fun. You'll have to wait for the ballad to hear the full story of that one. But you already know it starts out with some humor. And I will tell you, it ends epically. I think that's all on my list for now.
Oh, hey, you better wrap that up anyway. It looks like it's your turn. I'll get you set up.
Oh, my turn already, Benny? Great. Okay, admit it. You thought talking about a to-do list was going to be boring, too. I'm not surprised. Lists are not inherently exciting things. Maybe that's part of the reason for getting a similar reaction from people about a good portion of the Old Testament. We've got the exciting Sunday school stories to start it out, but then there's a bunch of lists of measurements and materials and instructions and directions for things that we don't do today, and more lists of names. The rest of the Old Testament contains Psalms and Proverbs, which we tend to like, a few more stories we're familiar with, a bunch of weird stuff where we don't really understand what's going on, and then we finally get to the New Testament, thank goodness. If I'm being honest, I used to read the Bible that way too. I'd get to the names that I can't pronounce or the oddly detailed and bloody descriptions of animal sacrifices, and my eyes would just glaze over. I tend to hear especially bad things about Leviticus. For whatever reason, people see these lists of sacrifices and descriptions of tabernacle worship, and they zone right out. It's skimmable. Focus on the keywords and get out fast. A couple years ago, I decided to start studying Leviticus and find out what it's all about. And I'm so glad I did. I've been slowly working my way through it ever since, and I love it. Because it turns out, Leviticus isn't a boring list of instructions that we don't even follow anymore. Leviticus is a story. To understand the story of Leviticus, you've got to have a little backstory. Where are we? How did we get here? What's going on? What year is it? We can't understand the importance of this story if we don't know why it ever mattered. So, here's where we're at. The year is 1446 BC, or, you know, close. The Israelites have just been brought out of Egypt after centuries in slavery. Over 400 years of bondage and oppression. Over 400 years being ruled by another nation. Over 400 years of crying out to God and getting no reply. Over 400 years of not knowing if God heard or even cared, and being more inclined to believe he didn't. And then freedom. God brings them through the waters, and they are free. They are their own people again, going into their own land, and everything is about to change. And not just because they are their own people again, but because they know they are God's people. He has heard them. He does care. And he is bringing them into something new. They are brought to Mount Sinai and stay encamped there for about a year. At Mount Sinai, they receive the Ten Commandments. They receive God's law. They receive instructions for worship and building the tabernacle. And most importantly, I think, they also receive the covenant. Here's what Exodus 19, verses 3 to 8 says about the giving of the covenant. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. What a beautiful picture. After centuries of slavery, believing God had abandoned them to Egypt, God saves them and assures them they were never forgotten. He reminds them of his power, the things he has done to show his love. And he declares that they are his, as long as they follow his commands. And the Israelites give a resounding yes. God has saved them. Of course they will follow him. And boy, do they not. Just a few chapters later, Aaron and the people have built a golden calf that they are worshiping as the one who brought them out of Egypt. Expressly what they are not supposed to be doing. And the worst part is, they know. They know that this golden calf that they have literally just crafted out of their own earrings is not the thing that saved them. They promised to do all that the Lord had commanded them. And they failed quickly, and they failed hard. God hasn't even finished giving them the whole law, and they've already proven themselves incapable of keeping it. And God could have ended it right there. He could have said, "Nope, you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. You broke the covenant. We're done." But he doesn't. There were still consequences. No one could be in the presence of God because of this broken covenant. But even though it was broken, God still wanted to uphold his end. God still wanted these broken, stubborn, foolish people to be his people. So instead of saying, "We're done," God said, "I'll make a way." God needs a way to make them right before him because he still desires a relationship with them and wants to reveal himself to them. When he said, "You will be mine," he revealed his heart for them. His purpose is not to make them do all the right things. His purpose is in that being, that they would belong to him and that they would know him. And so, in that desire to find a way, he gave them Leviticus, and he called to them. Leviticus begins with God calling to Moses from the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. And what God speaks to him isn't just a list of boring instructions. He's giving Moses the way back to him. What looks to us like a slightly confusing, mildly graphic description of several forms of animal sacrifice. What looks to us like instructions for weird clothes and ceremonies. What looks to us like a ton of oddly specific rules. These all reveal God's heart. They are God's way back to him. I actually find the picture of the sacrifices and the priests so beautiful. They have a holy, beautiful purpose. These sacrifices are forging a way back to God. They atone for sin, that inescapable breaking of the covenant. They show honor to God, the wholehearted worship he deserves that is such a struggle to give. They establish fellowship, communion with God, sharing in relationship. In every sacrifice, God's heart for his people is revealed, his heart for them to be near him. And the priests, set apart to perform the sacrifices for the people, to help guide them in worship and their relationship with God. Their whole purpose is to make God known, because he desperately wants his people to know him. Here's something that I was studying recently that really stuck out to me. Leviticus 9, verses 1 to 6 says, "On the eighth day, Moses summoned Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. He said to Aaron, Take a bull calf for your sin offering and a ram for your burnt offering, both without defect, and present them before the Lord. Then say to the Israelites, take a male goat for a sin offering, a calf and a lamb, both a year old and without defect, for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for a fellowship offering to sacrifice before the Lord, together with a grain offering mixed with olive oil. For today the Lord will appear to you. They took the things Moses commanded to the front of the tent of meeting, and the entire assembly came near and stood before the Lord. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded you to do, so that the glory of the Lord may appear to you. In the first part of Leviticus, we read God's instructions to the Israelites for how to do the various sacrifices. Sacrifices that will cover their sin, show honor to God, and establish fellowship between God and his people. Then we read about the priests. They've spent 7 days not moving from the entrance to the tent of meeting, preparing themselves for the ministry of the priesthood. And that's all culminated in this 8th day, when God will reveal his glory to his people. Can you even imagine what that would have been like? The anticipation of that time of preparation? The excitement? The fear? And then finally, the moment comes and you see God's glory. Leviticus 9, verses 22 to 24 says, then Aaron lifted his hands toward the people and blessed them, and having sacrificed the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the fellowship offering, he stepped down. Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting. When they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down. God made a way back to him, and he could be with his people again, dwelling among them. He already knows at this point they won't be able to keep these laws perfectly, or maybe even at all. In that if-then covenant, God knew they couldn't uphold the if, but he carried on the then anyways. The if is covered. This beautiful picture of love and relationship made the next chapter of Leviticus incredibly jarring to me. Two of Aaron's sons, priests, present what is called unauthorized fire before God. And God sends his own fire down and kills them. What happened to that atonement and forgiveness? What happened to that loving relationship? To see God's heart for his people revealed? His desire to be in close relationship with them? And then to kill two men? How do we reconcile that? Why did their sins require their deaths, when so many other sins were covered by the death of a sacrifice? I struggled with this passage, with this idea of a loving God's wrath. I don't think I'm alone in that. And I'm still not sure I completely understand it. But this is what I've been contemplating. Maybe these two ideas are not as at odds as we think. We think a loving, relational God could never be wrathful. But relationship requires knowing. God wants to be known by his people. And that includes his holiness. That way back to him doesn't work without his holiness. There is no loving God to be in relationship with without his holiness. Leviticus isn't the story of a strict, controlling God or a fed-up, angry God. This isn't the story of a God laying down an impossible list of rules for his people, trying to control everything they do and say, behaviorally modifying his delinquent little nation. This is the story of a God who loves his people so much that he would do anything to be near them. He knows them and loves them dearly anyway. and he wants them to know him in return. This is some of what I've been able to uncover in my study about God's heart in Leviticus and the story behind it all. It looks like nothing more than a list at first, but there are layers of story to unravel. Even a list can reveal the heart of the one who wrote it. God is a God who wants to be known, and he makes himself known. I may not always understand everything about him, and I won't ever fully understand everything. But I can know him, and I can continue to know him more, even from a list. So, thank you, my friends. That was how to understand the heart of an adventurer from their to-do list. I'll be back behind the bar for the rest of the night, so come see me for those refills. If you have to head out now, travel safe. Look for stories, even where you don't think there is one. And we look forward to seeing you again, here at the Barden Bible.